This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The reaction to immigrants in many communities is mixed. The founder of Not In Our Town says hate is preventable.
Who are neighbors that we need to know now in Bloomington Normal that we may not? Who might be vulnerable to hate or intolerance? How can we share each other's stories before misunderstandings, ignorance turns to hate?
Patrice O'Neill returns to Bloomington Normal for a Not In Our Town school event. We'll have the report. The plays for the next Illinois Shakespeare Festival season have been announced. You'll hear from the festival director. And what if there was an app that would answer your questions about recycling specific to Bloomington Normal? And what if it sent reminders to set out your recycling for pickup? You're in luck. You'll hear from the Ecology Action Center's Michael Brown. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's November 2nd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The climate for tolerance has significantly shifted in the national discourse over the last year. Cities across the U.S. are responding in different ways. Patrice O'Neill of the Not In Our Town movement is in Bloomington Normal for a panel discussion and documentary screening this evening at Moses Montefiore Temple. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, O'Neill lays out how various towns are coping with increasing hate.
I think the good news in all of this trauma, and it is trauma, for millions of people across the country, for millions of us, and the good news is that communities that have been prepared, that have been working at fostering an atmosphere of inclusion, are more prepared, that they're able to respond quickly and to talk to their neighbors who might be vulnerable and build relationships and make sure people feel more secure. I think that we don't have a handle on how deeply traumatized so many people are across our country. We know, for example, from a study by Southern Poverty Law Center, they were just marking how many hate incidents were reported just in the weeks after the election, and that the highest number of incidents occurred in K-12 schools. That's a really important factor, and it's not one that is well documented. We don't even know how our children are being affected. Where we are in the Bay Area, for example, we're learning more and more about places that that may have thought they were immune, places like Marin County, to these kinds of incidents, are finding more and more anti-Semitic attacks. Things like students saying, urging other people to do Heil Hitler signs, attacks towards young people where their students are confronting Latino students and saying, build a wall, you're going to be deported. I think it's causing an incredible amount of trauma to our children, to our communities. And so the good news is there are places like Bloomington Normal that have been preparing and are continuing this conversation about what we do to stand with each other at this turbulent time.
Why the elevated frequency in elementary schools as opposed to college or high school or just out in the community? What about... Is it the age and the lack of filter of kids and they're parroting what they hear at home, or is it some other factor that's causing the disproportionate increase in that group?
I don't think that we know enough to answer definitively. K-12 schools includes everything from kindergarten through high school. I think there are two factors that we need to pay attention to. One is that young people pick up what's in the atmosphere culturally. They pick up what's in the media. They hear it. They repeat it. And so they may not even understand the sort of bigoted things and the harmful things they're saying to their classmates, but they are hearing it and using it and causing incredible harm. The other thing that I think we don't adequately understand is how much these memes and this this white supremacy and neo-Nazi messaging is spreading through the internet. And we know that is the main communication source for all of our young people, for most people, actually. And we know it can be incredibly harmful. We also know that from Charlottesville and the series of hate group marches that have happened recently, that the white supremacist movement feels quite emboldened and that they are organizing on the internet and they're trying to spread their message. So there's awareness really matters, and getting these things out in the open and discussing them with your children, with your neighbors, with your friends, it's really essential.
In the area of sexual harassment, we've had this Harvey Weinstein moment, which has had all sorts of spinoffs around the nation. Can you foresee a similar such moment, an aha, and I'm not going to take it anymore response in the field of hate speech?
I hope so. I think that that sometimes people and people who don't feel the harm do not understand the pain, and when they don't feel it, it's easier for them to ignore it. And we're finally getting to this moment where men are acknowledging the impact of sexual harassment when they start. And I don't think we've seen that yet. We've seen media stories. We haven't seen real action that's going to make a difference in people's lives. We've seen a story about a big movie mogul who has harmed some actresses. But when we start seeing stories about the woman who works at, you know, in the office pool, and her coworkers who are men standing up for her, I think that will be a signal that we're really making a big difference. When we see people standing up for those same people, maybe it happens to be an African American woman who is called a term or treated unfairly, and people who are not African American are standing up for her, I think we start to see those signals. And it is those everyday acts that are going to make all the difference in the world, in our atmosphere, in our communities. And I think that's one reason we're so happy to be here in Bloomington Normal, because you've been practicing that for a while. And the young people in the schools are starting to practice that. And so we want to see what's happening here and if we can learn from many years of this work in this community.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Patrice O'Neill of the Not in Our Town movement, which brings us to preparedness and dialogue in the schools. And that's the focus of the evening event. How does one prepare kids to respond in that empathic, defending way?
Well, I think you start by surfacing it and creating a space in the classroom, in the home, in social situations, in within faith groups, for young people to talk about it and to feel safe to talk about it. You create a situation where there's a trusted adult in a school, in a social situation, where young people can feel that if they're harmed or they're the target, they can go to someone and then action will be taken. Not just that they've reported it and nothing happens, but something will be done about it. When you start to create protocols where parents know what they can do and how they can respond when something happens to their children, the difference will happen when young people feel the strength and that they are supported for standing up for themselves and for each other. And I'm really excited to meet with the students tonight to see how that's working.
The task becomes a lot more difficult, though, in an atmosphere of stridency where the voices of intolerance are emboldened and they are feeling represented by the administration in its efforts to exclude minorities and people of certain religions from the country. That raises the risk of speaking out and of standing up for their neighbors.
I think that removing politics from this discussion is really important, and talking about treatment and how people speak to each other and the kind of respect and dignity that we're going to give each other, a really basic core American value, a very basic community value that that hopefully your town wants to spread and many others do as well. And yes, I think there's stridency, but if we start treating each other with respect and give people, our young people, our children, a model to work with where we don't replicate that kind of behavior in our day-to-day interactions, they'll start doing that as well. And feel that they can come forward and have something to model after.
What are you hoping to take away from Bloomington Normal to use elsewhere?
So one of the reasons we came here is that we've been working on a project to look at, we've worked over these past 20 years, we've worked with hundreds of communities and watched hundreds of communities become involved with Not in Our Town, sometimes in the incidence of a crisis, right? Many times in the incidence of a crisis, whether it's a hate group coming to town or whether there's been an incident or a hate crime, and people call upon our films, our stories, our action steps through Not in Our Town, and we learn about what they've done. Sometimes they are places like this and quite a number of other towns that we've worked with for a long time. And what we've learned is that there are certain actions that are successful over and over and over again. So we pulled them together in a set of action steps or a criteria, and we're starting to pilot this program we call Gold Star Cities. And the idea is, Not in Our Town, Gold Star Cities, is that if you work on a plan together over a long period of time, because it never ends, right? The Not in Our Town group here in Bloomington has been around for over 20 years. And so I think their long-term commitment gives us a really powerful look at what can be done, what works, and the kind of commitment that's needed to really address something that is probably not going to go away in our lifetimes, but can get better. And so we're here to learn from leaders in Bloomington Normal about how they've done so far with these actions. Some of the criteria we've taken from the actions that have occurred here. Some of the criteria are new, and we'll be introducing them. And we're starting a conversation with some key leaders, one that we've already had with people on the steering committee, about what we can do in the long term. How can we create a more inclusive community? And I think the exciting part is that we're trying to create this sort of measurement that we look at, and towns can see where they stand across the country and sort of compare themselves, not individually to other communities, but the broad scope of how other communities are doing as well.
What is Bloomington Normal already doing, and what should they introduce?
Well, I think one of the things that is most powerful is this consistency. And we've watched a number of towns who we're piloting this project with and introducing it with. And there is a key factor that that is essential to the success of a community being able to stand up to bigotry and have some traction over time. And that is that you have to have the key institutions in your town, including the media, including schools and the city, local business, the libraries, the arts institutions, engaged in equal partnership with diverse community leaders who are vulnerable, who are targets. And this is really important so that the conversation and the the action steps are shared and developed together. And
so you must know your neighbors.
You must know your neighbors. And it's a really basic thing. When you start knowing people, when you start working together, there aren't enough studies on what needs to be done to reduce prejudice. The basic study was done by Gordon Alpert many years ago, and it was built upon by another researcher named Pettigrew. But contact theory is everything. If we start to know each other, if we start to have stories and narratives about each other, our ability to resist the implicit bias that's kind of baked into our DNA becomes much more powerful. And I think that's one of the strengths of Not in Our Town here in Bloomington Normal, is that people have been working together for a long time, and this community has consciously reached out to communities who are targets, and it's had an spreading group of people who are engaged in this work, reflecting the diversity that has broadened as the town has grown. So it's really good. I remember when quite a number of years ago, when you had new residents who were South Asian moving into town, there was a lot of tension, and there seems to be an incredible amount of engagement on the part of people in the NIAC group to engage people here, and involvement and leadership from people who have now been here for quite a while. I know after the Muslim ban, when we saw the gathering of 1,300 people in your downtown performing arts center saying, look, no matter where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbor, and we want to make sure that people feel safe in our community. This isn't about politics. This is about people knowing that we care about you and we care about your families. That is a really basic human thing. And there's a lot to learn from that kind of connection and that kind of contact that's built over time.
Patrice O'Neill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlie.
Patrice O'Neill is the executive director of the Not in Our Town movement. She spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. She's hosting a screening of a half-hour film about an attack on immigrants in a community and how that town came together. It's called A Light in the Darkness and is showing at 6:30 at the Moses Montefiore Temple on Robin Hood Lane in Bloomington. A panel discussion with students from Bloomington Normal Schools follows the 30-minute film. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Skin Dimensions Day Spa. Their licensed estheticians provide personalized plans for your skincare needs, including facials, peels, and microdermabrasion. Skin Dimensions Day Spa at Soderstrom Skin Institute proudly serves McLean County at 2100 Jacobson Drive, Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. The questions regarding recycling are nearly endless, from what to do with a car seat to Pop-Tart wrappers, or even the basics like, when do they pick it up? A new app called Recycling Coach is being rolled out by the Ecology Action Center and can help answer questions, provide alerts, and gives the EAC some insight into those doing the recycling. Michael Brown is the executive director of the Ecology Action Center. Michael, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
Bloomington Normal has been recycling for more than 40 years. How has it gotten harder to recycle?
So if we look at the consumer goods that we buy nowadays, if we look at the increasingly complex packaging that it all comes in, there's just more and more different materials or hard to identify materials. There's more types of plastic. There's mixed materials. It's gotten pretty confusing.
You and I have talked about the contamination rate of the recycling stream. That interview can actually be heard at WGLT.org. How will this app help people do a better job of recycling?
Sure. And so, yeah, the single stream automated curbside recycling in our community has done what it was intended to, in that it did help boost participation rates and volumes of materials being recycled by residents, which is huge. But it also did the side effect that we did anticipate, that it does increase contamination. And so this app gives people more detailed information. It kind of takes the nuance out of recycling information and listings. You know, 24 hours a day, people can access good, reliable information, detailed answers to their questions about recycling in our community.
You're not at the Ecology Action Center 24 hours a day. It seems like it sometimes.
I try not to be.
Do you think this app will bring more people to the bin, get people who aren't recycling to actually recycle?
I think our participation has increased, and so this can help that, you know, a bit more. But what can really help is help with that quality issue, the quality of the recycling that we're doing. That's what this can help increase.
The McLean County recycling rate is above 40% for the first time this year. What's that mean, and how do you think this app might increase the recycling rate?
Sure. And so we've been working, I think 12 years in the making to get to that 40% goal. It was set after we reached the initial mandated goal of 25% that the state set as they decreed that all communities needed to have a solid waste management plan. We finally hit that. A big boost in that was C&D recycling. Mm-hmm. Essentially, when Bloomington and Normal both started sending their bulk waste, these are, you know, old pieces of furniture or construction materials from remodeling jobs, things like that. When those started going to the Henson Disposal Recycling, Construction Demolition Recycling Facility, that we projected would boost us above the goal, and it did, which is great. What this does is this app can help, you know, increase that quality, make sure people are doing a better job reducing contamination, but also maybe open people's eyes to more things that they can recycle that they weren't aware of, because this isn't just about curbside. This is about all the various drop-off programs in our community, e-waste, clothing, textiles. This includes hazardous waste as well.
That's Michael Brown with the Ecology Action Center. We're talking about a new app, Recycle Coach, right? We're not,
yes,
Recycling Coach, Recycle Coach.
Recycle Coach.
I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. Walk me through some of the things this app can do. Give me some for instances.
Sure. And so to begin with, it's got a what goes where feature. And so this is kind of the most basic usage of it is anything. You're wondering how to dispose of or ideally recycle any object. And you start to type it in there, whether you're on your smartphone or access this through your browser on our website. The address for that is recyclebn.org. But you start typing it in, it's got this intuitive user face that it'll start to pull up things that match what you're looking for and pull up the actual listing. So it gets you there, it tells you more about that item, how that can be dealt with, where you can drop it off locally if it's not a curbside item, and or upcoming collection events. For example, right now, if you were to type in, you know, electronics into the app, it would pull up not only like the Town of Normal Public Works electronics recycling drop-off, Home Sweet Home Ministries, Habitat Restore, those consistent day-to-day recycling drop-offs. It would also show you the November 18th America Recycles Day event that the EEC is putting on at Elmwood Wesley in partnership with the Wellness Division there.
So I might be inclined to not put in electronics, but put in stereo or TV.
Exactly.
Will it deal with something more specific like that?
It will. And yes, so my apologies. I think in those broad terms. And so, yes, it would anticipate. Even when you start to type in stereo, it's going to finish a sentence like, you know, smartphone apps do nowadays. It's going to anticipate and kind of complete that for you. And then, yes, take you to stereo under the category of electronics, which, again, takes you to those sites or that event that's coming up.
By the way, I have an old stereo. Do you want it?
No, but I can show you where you can take it.
you can tell me where to put it. Is that, in other words, if someone asks a question about whether something can be recycled or not, who answers it? You're a small nonprofit organization with limited number of employees. So how does this work? Is it all automated?
So this is all automated. I mean, we spent, you know, a number of months working very closely with the City of Bloomington, Town of Normal, to get some of their data sets, you know, cleaned up for importation into this. As far as the geographic databases, because this is all geographically based for residents of Bloomington Normal. If you put your address into there, then it will give you geographic specific listings in terms of, you know, are you a single family homeowner or resident versus a apartment dweller? You know, the listings are going to vary in that you have curbside service in single family homes. Well, if you're in an apartment, it's going to direct you to drop-offs. And so anyway, that data importation and then taking all of our previous listings of recycling information from a website, importing it into databases. So this was a months-long process to clean all that up and import it into the system. And so it's all in there now. And we have the ability to update it as things change, as they do. But so, yes, people type in what they're looking for. The answers are automated. But yet we still maintain our traditional service. People can drop by. People can call us. We still will give them the more personalized answers as well.
And probably say, hey, by the way, did you know we had an app?
Exactly.
So I've had this app for a while. You turned me on to this. I get reminders. And in fact, I got a reminder Tuesday evening to put out my recycling and garbage out on for Wednesday morning.
Sure.
But I wasn't sure if the town was still picking up landscape waste.
Sure.
So I went to the calendar and the little green bin icon was there. So I assumed they would, and they did. But I thought it cut off at some point. And it looks like landscape waste, according to Recycle Coach, is there year-round. Is that something that you need to check on, or is it still some fine-tuning that still needs to be done with the app?
Sure. And so we've been using the app now for just a few months, and we are still working out some of those bugs. And so yeah, that being brought to my attention, that is something I should look into. Do we have, you know, the seasonal changes in some of the schedules up to date in there for the town, for the city, so that, yeah, we're not giving out misinformation.
And you mentioned the town and the city, but what if I live in rural McLean County or in Danvers or Chenoa, and I want to use this app, what kind of information will I get?
Sure. And so this app is applicable for all McLean County residents, but some of the biggest benefits come really for the urban area of Bloomington and Normal as far as the geographic specific answers. And so Bloomington and Normal residents, especially residents in single family homes, are going to get, you know, the most benefit, but everybody else can still benefit in that they can put in, you know, searches and get information about drop-off programs. They're just not going to get the information as far as what they can do with their curbside, because that varies a lot out in the other communities in the county, and some of those things are changing and evolving still, and we're not able to include all those at this time.
What's the adoption rate like? How many people are using it?
Sure. And so that's increasing all the time, and we're trying to promote it more and more, especially as we're more confident of, you know, how it works and that we got the bugs out. So at this point right now, we have a total of 1,327 total users. So close to 1,200 of those are web-based users, but then we do have smartphone subscribers as well. We have 65 users using the Android app and 87 using the iPhone app right now. So those are still pretty low, you know, in terms of what I think the potential of this is.
I'm surprised mobile is as low as it is. I'd figure that would be the leading.
I would think so, too. So we've got to,
because that's where I get my reminder, right? It just pops up exactly. Right on my phone. So you're at the beginning stages of building awareness. How are you going to increase usage?
Sure. And so, for example, this year at that upcoming America Recycles Day event, which our mega recycling event, where we take a lot of things like textiles, electronics and such, and the drive-through fashion. So we always actually, that I've always liked to say, that is a awareness event masquerading as a collection event, and that we do take things there, but actually the secret is at the end of that, we give everybody a flyer saying, you could recycle these materials any day of the week at these locations. And so this year, in addition to that information, we're going to tell them about the app. And so the app is going to then help them get more detailed information on a day-to-day basis about those programs. And so ideally, that event, that America Recycles Day, it might die eventually because of no attendance if we're so successful in promoting, you know, these alternate locations for regular usage.
And the flyer itself, it's recyclable?
Of course it is, and made on recycled paper.
Of course. What can you learn about users? Anything useful that the Ecology Action Center can use to tailor recycling programs or learn about people that are recycling, maybe boost that recycling rate beyond 42%?
Absolutely. And so in addition to just providing basic information, the app does provide more detailed information about recycling some of these different items. and it provides a quiz, an optional quiz. And so if recyclers want to see how they're doing and kind of their gauge their own understanding and performance as a recycler, there's a built-in quiz they can take. It's short and only takes like 5 minutes. So they can do that and get some feedback. But then as well, we get to look at that result as well. Not on the per person level. You know, I'm not going to know how you did on the quiz, unfortunately, Mike. I would like to know. So
I would be happy to sit down and fill the quiz out with you if you'd like.
If you're that curious. But we can look, you know, as an aggregate, how are people responding? Where do we need to actually help improve people's understanding of the system?
But again, people's privacy is not going to be violated by taking the quiz. It's an anonymous quiz. Yeah. So people can get this at the Google Play, at the Apple App Store.
Absolutely. So go to your applicable, you know, smartphone app store. Unfortunately, it's not available, you know, for Windows phones or for BlackBerry phones. Really just the Android and the iPhone. You can go to our website, and the shortcut again is recyclebn.org, which will take you to the browser-based version of it, but also right there it's got shortcuts to the app stores, so you can download it from there directly.
What about for non-English speakers?
Very good question. And so given that, you know, we do have a significant portion of our community that are Spanish speakers, the entire app is available in Spanish, all the same information. That's an extra service that we wanted to make sure that we provide for the community so that we can increase recycling among Spanish-speaking residents as well.
All right, Michael, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michael Brown is the Executive Director of the Ecology Action Center. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas on GLT. Governor Bruce Rauner recently criticized the Democrats for passing a spending plan that is more than $1 billion out of balance. That's according to analysis from his budget office. The same report noted that if one-time revenues are included, the state could see a surplus at the end of the year. Both Democrats and Republican governor and the Republican governor have made assumptions about the budget that aren't quite accurate. IPR's Mary Hansen talked with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield about the numbers from both sides and what it means for next year's budget.
Let's start with the Democrats' claim from the spring that their budget would produce a surplus. What has changed since then that makes that estimate incorrect?
Well, the Democrats put together a budget that counted on some stuff happening in the future that, as we move further into the fiscal year, did not occur. One is the Democrats were expecting that there would be a certain level of money collected into the state's general funds, which is the state's main checkbook account. The problem was that when the final tally came in for FY17, the actual receipts to the general funds were pretty much far below what the Democrats had counted on.
So they overestimated the amount of money coming in. What else did they get wrong?
The Democrats built into their budget, as Governor Rauner had built into the budget he proposed back in February, the assumption that by creating a new classification of public employee pensions and by having new hires go into this plan, the state would be able to save considerable money. The estimates range from $500 million to almost $1.5 billion. But then it develops that because of the complexity of the changes, the bottom line is that the pension systems say, no, we're not really able to put this into effect so that it will affect the amount of money the state has to put in FY18. So that was another area in which the savings that were projected just weren't going to be there.
The governor's office recently put out its own analysis of the budget, and with that, Rauner has been criticizing the Democrats for creating a huge deficit. What did that report show?
So when the governor's folks came out with their projection, they said that the deficit would be roughly $1.5 billion. But then they added in the bond proceeds, the additional federal reimbursement, borrowing from these other state funds. And they concluded that we may actually have a surplus of $2.2 billion.
Where do these federal reimbursements come from, and how does borrowing money help produce a surplus?
Now, the assumption is if you borrow the money, you can take those proceeds from the bond sale and use them to pay down some of the bill backlog. And to the extent you use the dollars to pay Medicaid providers, the federal government reimburses us 50 cents on the dollar. So you actually bring in more revenue by paying your bills, and you avoid having to pay the higher interest rates. And they also gave power to transfer money from some of the state's other accounts, close to the tune of about $1 billion, that would help us get through FY18.
So it seems like the state is in a good position ending the fiscal year and could come out ahead. What can we expect next year?
The surplus accrues because of the money we borrowed, either through selling bonds or through raiding these other funds, and that's not going to be there in FY19. And absent those additional revenue sources, the governor's projection for FY19, the fiscal year that starts next July 1, and the fiscal year for which lawmakers and the governor this coming spring will be developing the budget, the prediction is that we'll be roughly $1.6 billion in the red, so we'll be kind of back where we started.
Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, he talked with reporter Mary Hansen on Sound Ideas. Find out how residents of the historic David Davis Mansion celebrated Thanksgiving in the 1870s. The story is ahead. The 2018 season for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival has just been announced. The plays include the comedy The Merry Wives of Windsor, one of Shakespeare's best love history plays, Henry V, plus Shakespeare in Love by Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard. The season opens July 5th, and the plays running in rotation through August 11th. Tickets go on sale soon. At the helm for this season of the festival is an old friend in a new role. Laura Kennedy has more.
John Stark has deep roots at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Since 1993, he's designed 32 shows at the festival, beginning with an adaptation of Pericles. From shaping sets, Stark moves to shaping entire seasons at the ISF as its newly appointed artistic director. In his early years in theater, Stark trod the boards as an actor, but soon transitioned full-time to scenic design as well as teaching in the Illinois State University College of Fine Arts. Stark says, as a scenic designer, he's always been invested in every aspect of theater production.
I have a theatrical family. I'm married to an actress-director, Laurie Adams, which many people in the community know her and her work. My children are both performers. And so I've been always interested in the whole event of theater and involved with that, and especially the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. I think that it is exciting to be involved with this festival. It's been very important to me. I began in 1993, the festival, and I've done 18 seasons there. So it's been a large part of my professional life, and I've designed 32 shows, but every time I'm doing a show, I'm looking at the staging, I'm looking at ways to help my fellow collaborators, and all of that helps with the director and the whole production. I think my background in acting and being married to an actress, I think I'm very aware of the actor's need. Theater is the actor's craft, and they're our storytellers. They're the last, they're what brings a story to the audience, and so all of us, in a way, or in support of that activity, of the actor giving the story through the beautiful words of Shakespeare.
Well, coming to the festival in this new role, will you be drawing on the past work at the festival to guide you, or do you see yourself starting afresh?
I certainly am going to draw on a lot of the colleagues I've had over the years. I've worked with every artistic director except the founder, Cal Prittner. And so I have a lot of wonderful examples of different ways to do the work, but it will have to come from my own way of bringing it to the festival. So I'm certainly going to be drawing on different ways that they programmed productions, looking at the good ideas that they had. People like John Sipes, Cal McClain, Debbie Alley, Kevin Rich, all these artistic directors have brought different things to the festival that we will continue. There are also people I've worked with in the past that I plan to bring back, as well as bringing in new people. We're always bringing in new people to the festival from across the country.
Well, Kevin Rich was your immediate predecessor.
Yes.
He came from the Milwaukee theater scene, mm-hmm. and a lot of the actors and some of the directors he brought from Milwaukee. And then we also had Cal McClain, who was artistic director for a while. He had deep roots in the Chicago Chicago theater right. scene. So we brought a lot of Chicago artists in. Do you see yourself as drawing from a particular talent pool with regards to the festival?
I think that most of my experience would be more in Chicago, but I also have pretty deep roots in St. Louis as well. And I've done a little bit of work in Indiana. So I think that I have sort of a regional sort of bent, but probably heavily relying on the Chicago area and my experiences there. I've also recently traveled the country to other Shakespeare festivals and talked to and also auditioned actors from those festivals and very excited about meeting them and drawing from those festivals.
Well, in the recent past, there have been more new plays that have been going on at the Shakespeare Festival. First of all, do you intend to continue that trend? And have you also thought of perhaps commissioning works for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival?
I do. I'm very attracted to new plays, and that's exciting. I was involved with the first time the Q Brothers came with Q Gents. It was a very exciting work, and this last summer we just produced
I Heart Juliet. That sold out before it even started.
Right. Though that was probably some of our most recent commissioned work. Probably in the next couple seasons, we'll be looking at commissioning work and for our TYA show and some of those productions.
We will TYA look, is Theater for Young
Audiences, yeah. Which we do as a free production during the week and on Saturday morning. That's probably where we'll use that sort of idea for next season, at least. But I am interested in new work. I want to find ways to bring new work in, as long as we can also make it financially viable for us to attract an audience to the festival. Because number one, I need to support the actors and the performers and the whole company in producing good work. But we also have to take a look at the finances and make sure people are coming and make that all work out, too.
Well, you just mentioned the Theater for Young Audiences. Do you intend to expand festival outreach? Do you have any new ideas there?
The thing we're talking about mostly is taking it. We've been performing primarily in the Bloomington Normal area. We want to also expand out to the other regional cities of Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, Peoria, and Springfield. We see that all as that whole central Illinois as a big opportunity, an opportunity. We feel that Bloomington Normal, of course, is our base. They're our heart. They're our heart and soul of our audiences is right here in this community. But we want to draw further out to those other areas, and part of that will be looking at ways to take the TYA show into those communities and attracting, making people aware that we are here. We feel that we're the number one professional theater company in Central Illinois, where we have an equity company of professional actors, and that we're on the map. And so we want to make sure that all those communities know about us as well. And TY is one of those ways to do that.
See, that's the interesting thing about the Illinois Shakespeare Festival is it's not just about art. It's not just about theater, but it's about tourism as well.
Sure.
It's that bringing people into Bloomington Normal and getting them interested in what is going on in that theater that you had a hand in designing out there at Ewing.
I did. I was the liaison between the College of Fine Arts and the Illinois Shakespeare Festival with the contractors. And so I was on site just about every day when that was being built. And so I had a hand in planning it and also then seeing it through to the end construction phase, which was an amazing process because it got all done from one season to the next. We did not lose a season. And that's kudos to the contractors. And they're highly motivated, and this community stood behind it.
I loved how when they were just digging, and just getting the base ready, it was like I would drive by and it would look like an ancient Greek theater that was being excavated. I really liked that.
It was. And they dug down there and found the tennis courts that it was originally built on. And that's where it was first built, was on the tennis courts of the Ewing Manor. And so that asphalt blacktop was still there. But we dug through that and put in this new facility that is a little more friendly to the actors backstage than it used to be.
It has. It's positively luxurious compared to the way it used to be back there. What does that feel like to you? You're the man who helped build that theater, and now you're at the helm as the captain, so to speak. What does that mean to you, John?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud and I'm very honored to be in this position and to have the trust of Dean Gene Miller and Janet Wilson, the producer of Illinois Shakespeare Festival, who is also in the School of Theater and Dance. And to gain that trust means a lot to me. But I also know a lot about that building, and I have a few ideas about some physical changes and upgrades that can help us in small ways. ways. There's also a certain amount of maintenance we need to do because it has been 17 years since that was built, which is surprising, right?
It doesn't seem that long.
Like yesterday. Seems like yesterday, but it has been 17 years. So there's a little bit of upgrading to do, just having to do with weather and all those sorts of things. So but there's a few things I want to do in that way to upgrade and shape the space slightly differently than it has been. And I think I know a lot about how that can be done because I've seen it from the construction phase to working there as a scenic designer for all these 32 shows that I've designed there. And then any season I was not designing, I was attending and watching.
That's John Stark, the newly appointed artistic director for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. The new season will be announced early in November. I'm Laura Kennedy.
It's all in the Stark family at the Shakespeare Festival. John Stark's wife, Lori Adams, has appeared in the festival, along with their daughter, Anna, and son, Nathan, who cut their acting chops as youngsters at the festival. One of the many plays designed by Stark at the festival is Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Here's Mary Catterley singing a setting from the text. The song is called When That I Was. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
When that I was at a little tiny boy with hey ho, the wind and the rain. A foolish thing was but a toy for the rain, it rained every day.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Thanksgiving is fast approaching. The David Davis Mansion in Bloomington is offering a portrait of the holiday more than a century ago in a living history performance Saturday. Jeff Salisbury is the site manager for the David Davis Mansion. The event, Bountiful Feast, recreates Thanksgiving in the 1870s. Volunteers will portray servants and guests having Thanksgiving dinner. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Salisbury says those years were the early years of what we now think of as a traditional Thanksgiving.
Well, the Thanksgiving that we call Thanksgiving, the third Thursday of the month in November, was actually Abraham Lincoln. I want to say it was 1863. A lady named Sarah Josepha Hale had been pushing for several years to establish a single day each year to celebrate Thanksgiving. Before this point, Thanksgiving was actually just a day to give thanks. It was not thought of as Native Americans and pilgrims, that sort of thing. It was, say, a specific battle or a victory in the Civil War, they would have a day of Thanksgiving. But what Sarah Josepha Hale wanted to do was to make it a home-based family-type holiday, and that's where the tradition begins.
How, then, is a David Davis Mansion Thanksgiving different from the turkey and the cranberry and the pumpkin pie and the apple pie and the or green bean casserole, if you prefer, or whatever your family does?
Yeah, it won't be much different. That's actually what this is celebrating, is the traditional Thanksgiving, because the mansion was built in 1870 to 1872. So it's after Lincoln establishes the holiday. And then, again, Sarah Josepha Hale, she had a magazine, Godey's Home, Godey's Home magazine, something along those lines. And she started telling you what you should do for your traditional Thanksgiving turkey and all that kind of stuff. It's a very New England thing to start off with, and it spread across the entire country.
And, of course, the Davises were from New England originally.
Yes, Sarah was from New England, and the judge was from Maryland.
There are guests, there are servants. What perspectives do the servants have to offer?
Servants are much behind the scenes. The Davises, of course, when you get to that point, they're going to be sitting down having pie, talking politics and life in the time period. Servants are working. So you, when you come as a visitor, if you're not careful, it'll actually put you to work. They're cleaning things up, getting ready for the party. The cook in the kitchen teaches you how to light the stove, how things are done along those lines. Just a basic behind-the-scenes glimpse of what it takes to prepare a dinner for the upper middle class.
Will the servants be in character?
Yes, absolutely. They'll not break character. You won't be able to ask them things about the house or history, things like that, because as far as they're concerned, it's a specific day in 1872. It's not looking back from our time.
Were they all Irish or just some of them?
The ones that you'll see on Saturday are all Irish. And that was the majority of servants at that point in time were young Irish females coming over to America. This is their first job. But what they want to do, of course, is to get married and go to their own home, where they'll no longer be a paid servant.
Who were the guests?
The guests are different folks, Mr. and Mrs. Robinson, folks along those lines, just the upper crust of Bloomington society in the 1870s.
And what sort of politics are we talking about in the 1870s?
We are talking Republican politics. The judge is more, by this time, more independent, but the judge won't actually be there because, of course, at this time, the judge is in Washington, D.C. So what you're going to see is Sarah and her sort of salon, her friends, just having discussions of politics and life in the 1870s.
What is on the menu?
On the menu, well, all you're going to see is eating pie because it's too difficult to try to make a full dinner, to serve a full dinner, you know, 20 times in a given day. But they would have had things like several courses, soup course. There would have been appetizer, a fish course, a meat course, and just in a typical Victorian dinner. But it would be all the traditional things, turkey, cranberry sauce. We've got pumpkin pie. They'll have apple pie, lots of potatoes, of course. So not a huge difference from what you'll see today. Of course, some things weren't available to them, but it'd be about the same as you'll have today. Corn, squash.
Today is Thanksgiving. It turns into the start of the Christmas shopping season. But back then, not so much. What did it focus on?
Christmas, by this point in time, is not much different today. And actually, even at that point in time, they're still talking consumerism. That it's becoming, it's fun that we think that we're the first people to complain about consumerism and Christmas and all being tied together, but we're not even close. What we're going to be celebrating Christmas this year is Dickens, Charles Dickens. It's a long story. It's a great story. There's actually a movie coming out in November, The Man Who Invented Christmas, and we're going to try to do a lot of things to reflect that. The Dickens, Christmas in the Revolutionary time period was a little bit more of a raucous holiday. Guns in the air, hooligans coming to your door, asking for things, handouts, begging, stuff like that. And then people like Washington Irving wrote stories about traditional English Christmas that didn't actually exist. They just made it up out of whole cloth. Dickens comes over to America on one of his tours. He did several tours, speaking tours, in the early part of the 19th century. And he saw some of this going on, and he took it back to England and wrote A Christmas Carol. And then he just embellished and added to the traditional English Christmas. And it's just an amazing story that we're going to try to capture.
That's David Davis, Mansion Site Manager Jeff Salisbury, speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. A bountiful feast, living history, will be Saturday from 8 to 4 at the David Davis Mansion Historic Site on East Monroe Street in Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews from Charlie Schlenker and Laura Kennedy. Also, thanks to Michael Brown from the Ecology Action Center for his time. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.